4. The losers get the scoop.
The murders have started again, Mike said flatly. He looked up and down the table and then his eyes fixed on Bill's. The first of the new murders, if you'll allow me that rather grisly conceit, began on the Main Street bridge and ended underneath it. The victim was a gay and rather childlike man named Adrian Mellon. He had a bad case of asthma. Eddie's hand stole out and touched the side of his aspirator. It happened last summer on July 21st, the last night of the Canal Days Festival, which was kind of a celebration. A dairy ritual, Bill said in a low voice. His long fingers were slowly massaging his temples, and it was not hard to guess he was thinking about his brother George. George, who had almost certainly opened the way the last time this had happened.
A ritual, Mike said quietly, yes.
He told them the story of what had happened to Adrian Mellon quickly, watching with no pleasure as their eyes got bigger and bigger. He told them what the news had reported and what it had not, the latter including the testimony of Don Haggerty and Christopher Unwin about a certain clown which had been under the bridge like the troll in the fabled story of yore, a clown which had looked like a cross between Ronald McDonald and Bozo, according to Haggerty.
It was him, Ben said in a sick, hoarse voice. It was that fucker Pennywise.
There's one other thing, Mike said, looking at Bill. One of the investigating officers, the one who actually pulled Adrian Mellon out of the canal, was a town cop named Harold Gardner.
Oh, Jesus Christ, Bill said in a weak, teary voice.
Bill? Beverly looked at him, then put a hand on his arm. Her voice was full of startled concern. Bill, what's wrong?
Harold would have been about 5 then, Bill said. His stunned eyes searched Mike's face for confirmation.
Yes.
What is it, Bill? Richie asked.
Harold Gardner was the son of Dave Gardner, Bill said. Dave lived down the street from us back then when George was killed. He was the one who got to my brother first and brought him up to the house wrapped in a piece of quilt.
They sat silently, saying nothing. Beverly put a hand briefly over her eyes.
It all fits rather too well, doesn't it? Mike said finally.
Yes, Bill said in a low voice. It fits all right.
I'd kept tabs on the 6 of you over the years, as I said, Mike went on. But it wasn't until then that I began to understand just why I had been doing it, that it had a real and concrete purpose. Still, I held off, waiting to see how things would develop. You see, I felt that I had to be absolutely sure before I disturbed your lives. Not 90%, not even 95%. 100 was all that would do it. In December of last year, an 8-year-old boy named Stephen Johnson was found dead in Memorial Park. Like Adrian Mellon, he had been badly mutilated just before or just after his death, but he looked as if he could have died of just plain fright.
Sexually assaulted? Eddie asked.
No, just plain mutilated.
How many in all? Eddie asked, not looking as if he really wanted to know.
It's bad, Mike said.
How many? Bill repeated.
9, so far.
It can't be, Beverly cried. I would have read about it in the paper, seen it on the news, when that crazy cop killed all those women in Castle Rock, Maine, and those children that were murdered in Atlanta.
Yes, that, Mike said. I've thought about that a lot. It's really the closest correlative to what's going on here, and Bev's right, that really was coast-to-coast news. In some ways, the Atlanta comparison is the thing about all of this that frightens me the most, the murder of 9 children. We should have TV news correspondents here, and phony psychics and reporters from the Atlantic Monthly and Rolling Stone, the whole media circus, in short.
But it hasn't happened, Bill said.
No, Mike answered, it hasn't. Oh, there was a Sunday supplement piece about it in the Portland Sunday Telegram, and another one in the Boston Globe after the last 2. A Boston-based television program called Good Day did a segment this February on unsolved murders, and one of the experts mentioned the Derry murders, but only passingly. And he certainly gave no indication of knowing there had been a similar batch of murders in 1957-58 and another in 1929-30. There are some ostensible reasons, of course. Atlanta, New York, Chicago, Detroit. Those are big media towns. And in big media towns, when something happens, it makes a bang. There isn't a single TV or radio station in Derry, unless you count the little FM the English and Speech Department runs up at the high school. Bangor's got the corner on the market when it comes to the media. Except for the Derry News, Eddie said, and they all laughed. But we all know that doesn't really cut it with the way the world is today. The communication web is there, and at some point the story should have broken nationally, but it didn't. And I think the reason is just this. It doesn't want it to. It, Bill mused almost to himself. It, Mike agreed. If you have to call it something, you might as well be what we used to call it. I've begun to think, you see, that it has been here so long, whatever it really is, that it's become a part of Derry. Something as much a part of the town as the standpipe or the canal or Bassey Park or the library. Only it's not a matter of outward geography, you understand. Maybe that was true once, but now it's inside. Somehow it's gotten inside. That's the only way I know to understand all of the terrible things that have happened here. The nominally explicable, as well as the utterly inexplicable. There was a fire at a Negro nightclub called the Black Spot in 1930. A year before that, a bunch of half-bright Depression outlaws was gunned down on Canal Street in the middle of the afternoon. The Bradley Gang, Bill said. The FBI got them, right? That's what the histories say, but that's not precisely true. So far as I've been able to find out, and I'd give a lot to believe that it wasn't so, because I love this town. The Bradley Gang, all seven of them, were actually gunned down by the good citizens of Derry. I'll tell you about it sometime. There was the explosion at the Kitchener Ironworks during an Easter egg hunt in 1906. There was a horrible series of animal mutilations that same year that was finally traced to Andrew Rulin, the granduncle of the man who now runs the Rulin Farms. He was apparently bludgeoned to death by the three deputies who were supposed to bring him in. None of the deputies were ever brought to trial. Mike Hanlon produced a small notebook from an inner pocket and paged through it, talking without looking up. In 1877, there were four lynchings inside the incorporated town limits. One of those that climbed a rope was the lay preacher of the Methodist Church, who apparently drowned all four of his children in the bathtub as if they were kittens, and then shot his wife in the head. He put the gun in her hand to make it look like suicide, but no one was fooled. A year before that, four loggers were found dead in a cabin downstream on the Kanduskeag, literally torn apart. Disappearances of children of whole families are recorded in old diary extracts, but not in any public document. It goes on and but perhaps you get the idea. I get the idea, all right, Ben said. Something's going on here, but it's private. Mike closed his notebook, replaced it in his inner pocket, and looked at them soberly. If I were an insurance man instead of a librarian, I'd draw you a graph, maybe. It would show an unusually high rate of every violent crime we know of, not excluding rape, incest, breaking and entering, auto theft, child abuse, spouse abuse, assault. There's a medium-sized city in Texas where the violent crime rate is far below what you'd expect for a city of its size and mixed racial makeup. The extraordinary placidity of the people who live there has been traced to something in the water, a natural trank of some kind. The exact opposite holds true here. Derry is a violent place to live in an ordinary year. But every 27 years, although the cycle has never been perfectly exact, that violence has escalated to a furious peak, and it has never been national news. You're saying there's a cancer at work here, Beverly said. Not at all. An untreated cancer invariably kills. Derry hasn't died. On the contrary, it has thrived. In an unspectacular, unnewsworthy way, of course. It is simply a fairly prosperous, small city in a relatively unpopulous state where bad things happen too often and where ferocious things happen every quarter of a century or so. That holds true all down the line? Ben asked. Mike nodded. All down the line. 1715 to 16, 1740 until roughly 1743, that must have been a bad one, 1769 to 70, and on, right up to the present time. I have a feeling that it's been getting steadily worse, maybe because there have been more people in Derry at the end of each cycle, maybe for some other reason. And in 1958, the cycle appears to have come to a premature end, for which we were responsible. Bill Denborough leaned forward, his eyes suddenly bright. You sure of that? Sure? Yes, Mike said. All the other cycles reached their peak around September and then ended in a big way. Life usually took on its more or less normal tenor by Christmas, Easter at the latest. In other words, there were bad years of 14 to 20 months every 27 years. But the bad year that began when your brother was killed in October of 1957 ended quite abruptly in August of 1958.
Why?
Eddie asked urgently. His breath had thinned. Bill remembered that high whistle as Eddie inhaled breath and knew that he would soon be tooting on the old lung sucker.
What did we do?
The question hung there. Mike seemed to regard it, and at last he shook his head. You'll remember, he said. In time, you'll remember. What if we don't? Ben asked. Then God help us all.
9 children dead this year, Rich said. Christ!
Lisa Albrecht and Stephen Johnson in late 1984, Mike said. In February, a boy named Dennis Torrio disappeared, a high school boy. His body was found in mid-March in the Barrens, mutilated. This was nearby. He took a photograph from the same pocket into which he had replaced the notebook. It made its way around the table. Beverly and Eddie looked at it, puzzled, but Richie Tozier reacted violently. He dropped it as if it were hot.
Jesus! Jesus, Mike!
He looked up, his eyes wide and shocked. A moment later, he passed the picture to Bill. Bill looked at it and felt the world swim into gray tones all around him. For a moment, he was sure he would pass out. He heard a groan, and he knew he had made the sound. He dropped the picture.
What is it?
He heard Beverly saying. What does it mean, Bill? It's my brother's school picture, Bill said at last.
It's Georgie.
The picture from his album. The one that moved. The one that winked. They handed it around again then, while Bill sat as still as stone at the head of the table looking out into space. It was a photograph of a photograph. The picture showed a tattered school photo propped up against a white background, smiling lips parted to exhibit two holes where new teeth had never grown. Unless they grow in your coffin, Bill thought and shuddered. On the margin below George's picture were the words, School Friends, 1957-58.
It was found this year? Beverly asked again.
Mike nodded, and she turned to Bill. When did you last see it, Bill? He wet his lips, tried to speak. Nothing came out. He tried again, hearing the words echo in his head, aware of the stutter coming back, fighting it, fighting the terror.
I haven't seen that picture since 1958.
That spring, the year after George died, when I tried to show it to Richie, it was gone. There was an explosive, gasping sound that made them all look around. Eddie was setting his aspirator back on the table and looking slightly embarrassed.
Eddie Kasprak blasts off, Richie cried cheerfully.
And then suddenly and eerily, the voice of the movie-tone newsreel narrator came from Rich's mouth.
Today in Derry, a whole city turns out for Asthmatics on Parade, and the star of the show is Big Ed the Snothead, known all over New England as...
He stopped abruptly, and one hand moved toward his face as if to cover his eyes, and Bill suddenly thought, no. No, that's not it. Not to cover his eyes, but to push his glasses up on his nose. The glasses that aren't even there anymore. Oh, dear Christ, what's going on here? Eddie, I'm sorry, Rich said. That was cruel. I don't know what the hell I was thinking about. He looked around at the others, bewildered. Mike Hanlon spoke into the silence. I promised myself after Stephen Johnson's body was discovered that if anything else happened, if there was one more clear case, I would make the calls that I ended up not making for another 2 months. It was as if I was hypnotized by what was happening, by the consciousness of it, the deliberateness of it. George's picture was found by a fallen log less than 10 feet from the Torrio boy's body. It wasn't hidden. Quite the contrary. It was as if the killer wanted it to be found, as I'm sure the killer did.
How did you get the police photo, Mike?
Ben asked. That's what it is, isn't it? Yes, that's what it is.
There's a fellow in the police department who isn't averse to making a little extra money. I pay him $20 a month, all that I can afford. He's a pipeline. The body of Dawn Roy was found 4 days after the Torrio boy, McCarran Park, 13 years old. Decapitated. April 23rd of this year, Adam Terrault, 16, reported missing when he didn't come home from band practice, found the next day just off the path that runs through the Greenbelt behind West Broadway, also decapitated. May 6th, Frederick Cowan, 2 and a half, found in an upstairs bathroom, drowned in the toilet.
Oh, Mike, Beverly cried.
Yeah, it's bad, he said, almost angrily. Don't you think I know that?
The police are convinced that it couldn't have been, well, some kind of accident? Bev asked.
Mike shook his head. His mother was hanging clothes in the backyard. She heard sounds of a struggle, heard her son screaming. She ran as fast as she could. As she went up the stairs, she said she heard the sound of the toilet flushing repeatedly. That and someone laughing. She said it didn't sound human.
And she saw nothing at all? Eddie asked.
Her son, Mike said simply. His back had been broken, his skull fractured. The glass door of the shower stall was broken. There was blood everywhere. The mother is in the Bangor Mental Health Institute now. My police department source says she's quite lost her mind.
No fucking wonder, Richie said hoarsely. Who's got a cigarette?
Beverly gave him one. Rich lit it with hands that shook badly.
The police line is that the killer came in through the front door while the Cowan boy's mother was hanging her clothes in the backyard. Then, when she ran up the back stairs, he supposedly jumped from the bathroom window into the yard she'd just left and got away clean. But the window is only one of those half-sized jobs. A kid of 7 would have to wriggle to get through it. And the drop was 25 feet to a stone-flagged patio.
Rademacher doesn't like to talk about those things, and no one in the press, certainly no one at the news, has pressed him about them.
Mike took a drink of water and then passed another picture down the line. This was not a police photograph. It was another school picture. It showed a grinning boy who was maybe 13. He was dressed in his best for the school photo, and his hands were clean and folded neatly in his lap, but there was a devilish little glint in his eyes. He was black.
Jeffrey Holly, Mike said, May 13th, a week after the Cowan boy was killed. Torn open. He was found in Bassey Park by the canal.
9 days after that, May 22nd, a fifth grader named John Fury was found dead out on Niebolt Street. Eddie uttered a high, quavering scream. He groped for his aspirator and knocked it off the table. It rolled down to Bill, who picked it up. Eddie's face had gone a sickish yellow color. His breath whistled coldly in his throat.
Get him something to drink, Ben roared. Somebody get him!
But Eddie was shaking his head. He triggered the aspirator down his throat. His chest heaved as he tore in a gulp of air. He triggered the aspirator again and then sat back, eyes half closed, panting.
I'll be all right, he gasped. Give me a minute. I'm with you.
Eddie, are you sure? Beverly asked.
Maybe you ought to lie down.
I'll be all right, he repeated querulously. It was just the shock, you know, the shock. I'd forgotten all about Niebolt Street.
No one replied. No one had to. Bill thought, you believe your capacity has been reached, and then Mike produces another name and yet another, like a black magician with a hat full of malign tricks, and you're knocked on your ass again. It was too much to face all at once, this outpouring of inexplicable violence, somehow directly aimed at the 6 people here, or so George's photograph seemed to suggest.
Both of John Fury's legs were gone, Mike continued softly, but the medical examiner says that happened after he died. His heart gave out. He seems to have quite literally died of fear. He was found by the postman, who saw a hand sticking out from under the porch.
It was 29, wasn't it? Rich said, and Bill looked at him quickly.
Rich glanced back at him, nodded slightly, and then looked at Mike again. 29 Niebolt Street. Oh, yes, Mike said in that same calm voice. It was number 29. He drank more water. Are you really all right, Eddie? Eddie nodded. His breathing had eased. Rademacher made an arrest the day after Fury's body was discovered, Mike said. There was a front-page editorial in the news that same day, calling for his resignation, incidentally. After 8 murders, Ben said. Pretty radical of them, wouldn't you say? Beverly wanted to know who had been arrested. A guy who lives in a little shack way out on Route 7, almost over the town line and into Newport, Mike said. Kind of a hermit. Burned scrap wood in a stove, roofed the place with scavenged shingles and hubcaps. Name of Harold Earl. Probably doesn't see $200 in cash money over the course of a year. Someone driving by saw him standing out in his dooryard, just looking up at the sky, on the day John Fury's body was discovered. His clothes were covered with blood. Then maybe, Rich began hopefully. He had 3 butchered deer in his shed, Mike said. He'd been jacking over in Haven. The blood on his clothes was deer blood. Rademacher asked him if he killed John Fury, and Earl is supposed to have said, "Oh, yeah, I killed a lot of people. I shot most of them in the war." He also said he'd seen things in the woods at night. Blue lights, sometimes, floating just a few inches off the ground. Corpse lights, he called them. And Bigfoot. They sent him up to the Bangor Mental Health. According to the medical report, his liver's almost entirely gone. He's been drinking paint thinner. Oh, my God, Beverly said. And is prone to hallucinations. They've been holding on to him, and until 3 days ago, Rademacher was sticking to his idea that Earl was the most likely suspect. He had 8 guys out there, digging around his shack and looking for the missing heads, lampshades made out of human skin, God knows what. Mike paused, head lowered, and then went on. His voice was slightly hoarse now. I'd held off and held off, but when I saw this last one, I made the calls. I wish to God I'd made them sooner. Let's see, Ben said abruptly. The victim was another 5th grader, Mike said, a classmate of the Fury boy. He was found just off Kansas Street, near where Bill used to hide his bike when we were in the Barrens. His name was Jerry Bellwood. He was torn apart. What was left of him was found at the foot of a cement retaining wall that was put in along most of Kansas Street about 20 years ago to stop the soil erosion. This police photograph of the section of that wall where Bellwood was found was taken less than 30 minutes after the body was removed. Here. He passed the picture to Rich Tozier, who looked and passed it on to Beverly. She glanced at it briefly, winced, and passed it on to Eddie, who gazed at it long and raptly before handing it on to Ben. Ben passed it to Bill with barely a glance. Printing straggled its way across the concrete retaining wall. It said, "Come home. Come home. Come home." Bill looked up at Mike grimly. He had been bewildered and frightened. Now he felt the first stirrings of anger. He was glad. Angry was not such a great way to feel, but it was better than the shock, better than the miserable fear. "Is that written in what I think it's written in?" "Yes," Mike said. "Jerry Bellwood's blood."